Today on Against the Grain, capitalism has generated vast amounts of wealth by spreading around the world. But as Timothy Mitchell argues, profits are made not just across space, but also time, by stealing from future generations, including through military spending.
Whether it's the threat of the immigrant at home or the threat of Iranians abroad, if there is some threat that can be imagined and showed to meet this extraordinary level of violence and of spending, you help sustain exactly the modes of placing burdens on the future that will enable continued enrichment of the few in the present.
The political theorist and historian of the Middle East reflects on the ways that capitalism consumes the future. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's a commonplace that economic growth comes from the investment of past savings into new technologies and other innovations that improve all of our lives going forward and the lives of those who come after us. But what if that's wrong? That growth under capitalism is significantly based on profiting from the future to the detriment of the next generations? Timothy Mitchell makes that argument in The Alibi of Capital, How We Broke the Earth to Steal the Future on the Promise of a Better Tomorrow. He's also the author of Carbon Democracy and professor of Middle East Studies at Columbia University. Tim, can you begin by telling us how the ride-hailing service Uber epitomizes the ways that capitalism enriches some in the present by drawing from the future?
Well, I use the example of Uber to illustrate a much wider process of the way we've come to live by selling in the present claims on future livelihoods. So Uber is an example of a large corporation that sells shares, and those who buy the shares, what they're buying is a share of the future profits of the company, and thus a claim not only on those profits in the future, but a claim that is going to be maintained against the demands of drivers for better wages or the demands of passengers for lower fare payments. So it exemplifies a way of organizing collective life where there is some stream of revenue in the future, and it's the payments for rides that people might make for riding in Uber or another car service company. And those future claims can be transformed into something that is available to the well-to-do in the present, because they can buy shares in that future. And that relationship between those in the present and the future that will have to pay back is, to my mind, a central aspect of the way capitalism is organized, not only today in the days of tech and giant corporations, but throughout its history.
And in the case of Uber, of course, when the company went public, I think it was 2019, the kind of returns that people expected to get from Uber, these claims on the future, were rather astounding.
Yes, and the interesting thing is what makes those astounding claims possible. And what makes them possible is not just that Uber is a company offering ride services, though other companies, including local taxi and car service firms. What made them possible was the ambition of Uber to become a monopoly, or at the very least to have to share this service with only one or two other companies across the US and even other parts of the world. And it's that monopolistic nature of the future that it was laying out that was the promise of extraordinary returns for the purchase of those shares in future income.
And you argue that that relationship, those sort of claims on the future, really characterize the way that our world is structured. And you're saying that the implications are actually very serious ones. And I wanted to ask you, in trying to understand your argument, how would you say are our lives now burdened by paying for things done by previous generations?
So this method that Uber uses is, of course, that of the joint stock company. And the joint stock company in its modern form has been around for 150 years or so. There are earlier forms that we could talk about. But these ways of encumbering the future takes the form of selling that future in the present at a discount. Because when you buy, whether it's shares in Uber or any other future revenue stream that is made available to investors in the present, that future is being discounted. So when it comes to be paid back through the profits of the company in the future, it will be paid back at full price. Now, the way we are living today is the consequence of that system having been in place on an enormous scale for the last generation or two, and in other ways, over more than a century. So each generation is living with the having been imposed on it the cost of paying back those earlier predations on the future. So there were many other examples that would the forms of debt we live with today, the forms of debt imposed and has to be repaid for a whole variety of services are examples of that continuing situation.
Can you give us some examples of such things?
The most prevalent form beyond that of the corporation itself. So let's just say a little bit more about the form of the corporation. So every corporation sells shares, every shareholder corporation. And those shares are not a way a corporation raises money. They're simply selling claims on its future profits. Now, the shareholder corporation has become an ubiquitous way of organizing the running of business. But there are other examples, the building of infrastructure projects, which are paid for by future forms of revenue, tolls and service fees and user fees, that will have to be paid back by those who are later users of that form of infrastructure. Or the payment for medical service, for educational services, for all kinds of normal forms of collective life that rather than being funded out of public funds are funded through selling the rights to those future revenues to investors who then profit from the increase in the value of their investment. And then again, those who come later paying for, let's say, medical services provided by a hospital have to pay back the investment gain of the investor who acquired the rights to the future services being provided by, let's say, a hospital. It now is a principle that governs, as I say, almost every area of monetized collective life.
And this is in contrast, at least, to the idea that's commonly held that when we think about investments that are made, that those actually draw from not the future, you know, not from promises of revenues from the future, but from accumulated savings from the past. Do you think that's wrongheaded or partially true, but partially not?
There's an element of that that happens. But one of the reasons I was able to write this book is that there's been a fundamental transformation in the way in which we understand money and credit, carried out by a number of scholars in recent years and decades. It used to be thought that money was a fund that people gathered, and they used money as a way of storing wealth, and they also used money to facilitate exchange and so on. That's now understood to be nothing connected with the way almost all money works. Almost all money comes into being as credit, and as credit created by banks largely and other financial institutions, in which it makes a loan. And that loan is not loaning out money that has been placed in deposits by other people. There may be a very small amount of that, but almost all of it is simply extending a loan to its most creditworthy customers so that they can have some claim on a future revenue. So, simple example, it might be a loan to build a house, and the value of that future house will be set not by the cost of its building, but by the revenue that can be made by renting it or living it in the future. So, banks, in lending money, credit money that they create, establish that relationship to the future. It's not a system of saving up from the past to involve in the construction of speculative housing or any other way in which we used to think of a method of saving up from the past and investing that in the future.
We'll return to this later, but I wanted to ask you about the climate crisis, which has shone a very bright light on our relationship to the future, that we are borrowing, in effect, from future generations to burn fossil fuels in the present. How you make sense of that? Because, of course, there has been a whole world of analysis over the last several decades as an awareness of the climate crisis has increased to say, but with the climate and also nature more broadly, we're just not accounting for it right. Like if we put a price on nature, then we would be able to see the degree of destruction in monetary terms, and that would allow us to make it all visible. Why do you think that these sorts of ways that we have destroyed non-human nature into the future have seemed so invisible to us?
First of all, I think the kind of analysis of the climate crisis and the costs of the climate crisis have been a very important way of thinking about this strange relationship we have to the future. And one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is expand from that to show that the particular way we indebt and impoverish the future through placing carbon in the atmosphere is actually only one part, even if it's perhaps the most threatening part, of a much wider process of indebting and placing burdens on those who come later. The difference, as you say, with the climate crisis is that that is an example of burdens placed on the future that are not even costed, that are not even made available at a discount in the present to be paid back at full price. Pollution is something made available for free, at least historically. There is almost no cost placed in the present on the ability to impose that burden on the future. So while climate is the most powerful example of this, it also operates in a somewhat exceptional way by not costing those. Now, of course, some of the mainstream attempts in economics to do something about the climate crisis, most famously the work of the economist, the American economist William Nordhaus, said, well, the way to deal with this is actually to do this process of assessing the cost of future burdens and seeing what their current cost is. In other words, do the same process of taking a future, in this case, a future cost, and discounting it and see what its value is in the present. And the result of those calculations from the work of Nordhaus and some of his colleagues was that we should do nothing about the climate crisis, because as you go through the process of discounting and making future either payments or costs available, you get to a point where they are so far in the future that they're not worth even calculating. So the climate crisis is sort of unusual in both respects, both that it's not actually paid for, and two, if there were attempts to make people pay for it by thinking about those future costs were thought to be far enough off 50 years or more that the current method of calculating future costs or payments rendered them negligible.
Timothy Mitchell is my guest. He's a political theorist and historian. We're discussing the alibi of capital, how we broke the earth to steal the future on the promise of a better tomorrow. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So in terms of this question of what we do or don't see when we're looking at the future in terms of our actions today, how is technology often deployed as an explanation for why we're not borrowing from the future, but that we are innovating and making, you know, future horizons broader?
Technology is one of the examples of what I call the alibis of capital, in the title of the book. An alibi, of course, is not just a sort of excuse or a cover, but it's a way of misdirecting people. It literally means, you know, over there, somewhere else, look elsewhere. So it's a particular mode of having people look elsewhere for the explanations for our destructive and impoverishing modes of living. And technology works in that way at two levels. First of all, in mainstream economics, the term technology is almost synonymous with the word capital. If people are looking for an explanation for our relationship to the future and the relationship of capital to the future, they will tell you that that relationship is organized and mediated by this thing called technology. And technology means those kinds of innovations and those forms of equipment that give us what is called growth. And growth is another of the alibis that I look at in the book in ways we could talk about. Again, I can go back to the example of Uber that the book opens with. Uber explained the extraordinary profits it was expecting to make, not in terms of the kinds of monopoly it would be able to establish, not in terms of the ways it would continually increase the costs for those who would ride, or the increasing impositions on drivers whose fares and wages would go down, but saying, we've got a technology, we've got a new technology, and these future profits are simply the reward for that technology. But if you look at it closely, there was nothing that was technologically new. I mean, Uber was a car service company. Cars are nothing new. The GPS that they use to navigate is nothing new and nothing paid for by Uber, paid for rather out of public funds because it's provided by the United States Air Force. The internet that connects these devices together was something produced out of public funds. So nothing technical and nothing technological in what that firm was doing was either provided by the firm itself, or, on the other hand, the source of the profits it was to make. So that's an example of the way in which a sort of claim to some kind of technological innovation is used to justify the extraordinary gains that are actually coming from all the modes in which large firms establish monopolistic or quasi-monopolistic control over future revenues. And there are many examples of that going back through 100, 200 years of history that the book looks at.
Well, I want to ask you precisely about that, about the kind of crucial form of shareholder-owned firms. But before I do that, I wonder if you could tell us what preceded them, because this history doesn't just start in the last century and a half. What was the predecessor for the joint stock company, and how did it help the transformation, not just of the way that the colonization, the world that we could think of in kind of spatial terms, took place, but also these claims on not just space, but also on time?
The joint stock company in its contemporary form is a relatively recent invention in the last 150 years. It's associated particularly with the railroad boom of the later 19th century and the possibilities for the control of future revenues that the sort of scale and longevity of railways allowed. There were earlier forms of the joint stock company, particularly the colonizing corporations with which European countries established violent control over world trade. But the book goes back earlier to a period before the 19th century and before the Industrial Revolution, when Europe was still something of a periphery to worldwide forms of trade and of credit. It shows that credit was always an important part of merchant life and of the relationship between merchants and producers, particularly agricultural producers, and it looks at some of the history of those forms of credit. But it also looks at how the ability to profit from credit, to profit from making loans available and then recouping them from the future, was limited. It was limited by the scale and duration of the crop cycle, which is typically a kind of annual cycle. It was limited by the duration of trade journeys, of the merchants sending out ships or sending out in other forms, commodities to be traded and to come back. And so the profit you would make by financing that was somewhat limited to those kinds of scales. And one of the things that changes is this, the change in the durability and the scale of that. And railways are a very good example of that, because suddenly you were building something that could promise a revenue not over the course of a crop cycle and not over the course of a, say, a 2 or 3 year trading journey, but over the course of the 10 or 20 or 30 year life of the railway. And the other thing about what existed before, and particularly if one thinks of a sort of world economy that was very much centered, not in Europe prior to the 18th century, but if you like, in the Islamicate world, in the world that stretched from the eastern and southern shores of the Mediterranean, right across the Middle East and across North India, a vibrant trading culture, but one that placed a certain kind of limit on the provision of credit. The limit being that it was made very hard to claim some automatic interest payment. You could make a kind of gain from interest, but it was limited again in the ways I've just suggested, and also by the fact that if you were going to get extremely rich by putting people into debt, there had to be some mechanism of enforcing debt payment. And one of the things we know about the emergence of early modern European states is they kind of pioneered a new way of making debtors pay. The entire legal structure of early European states was in many ways a debt repayment system. So one had earlier forms of credit, one had global forms of trade, but they were limited by the forms of violence and the forms of coercion and the forms of policing that were available. If those who want to provide credit haven't got that kind of coercive power backing them up, they're limited and they're forced to be a little bit more reasonable about how far they try and go in placing people in debt. And that's something that is then continually broken down in successive ways over the course of the 18th, 19th, 20th century, as ever new ways are found of indebting people, indebting countries, and so on.
How significant then was the rise of what we know as the joint stock company in the 19th century? How ubiquitous did it become, and to what degree was it successful at entangling people in the future without some of those earlier means?
Well, one of the interesting things is that, of course, the kind of central event of the first half of the 19th century and getting back into the 18th century is the Industrial Revolution, which I also have a slightly different history of in the book. The Industrial Revolution didn't much depend on the form of the joint stock company. Businesses were typically established as partnerships and family firms. And the joint stock company, as I've suggested, it had earlier histories, but it comes back in the second half of the 19th century around the building of railways, because those are structures, as they say, with a temporality and a durability that is entirely new, and therefore credit can be created on this new kind of scale. And she said, you know, we often think of credit and, you know, we often use terms like sort of financialization to explain periods of great expansion of credit, and the recent ones, but also the ones of the late 19th century, which often rely on the notion that financialization is something sort of fictitious, that it's based on future claims that are unreal, that do not represent real capital. But there was nothing fictitious about this. And just because something is in the future or is a claim on the future doesn't mean it's fictitious. On the contrary, one of the things that the book is trying to say, in contrast to many of the debates about finance and financial crises, is that it was actually the durability of the technical structures, but also of the political arrangements, of the policing, of the enforcement. It was the power and the durability of those arrangements that made possible these expansions of credit. And having been pioneered or re-pioneered in the form of railways, they were then extended to other very large, more durable kinds of apparatuses, the iron and steel industry, and perhaps above all others, the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry in general from the late 19th, early 20th century, which It tends to be justified because of the scale of these things, and therefore they needed a lot of investment. But sale of stock wasn't the main source of investment. What they were selling was the durability of these revenues. And again, if you think of the history of oil companies, that durability was something built out of imperial power, out of the ability to claim oil revenues of countries in Latin America, in the Middle East, and so on, and to do that in monopolistic ways, and to back it up with the threat of war or coups or other kinds of military violence that ensured the durability of those revenues.
Can you explain what you mean by durability here, so listeners can understand the way you're describing the power of these ways of structuring claims on the future?
Making this contrast between earlier periods where claims on future revenue tended to be limited by the duration of a trade cycle or a crop cycle or something of that sort, to a period where a stream of future revenues is guaranteed over a lot longer period, and that guarantee of the longevity of the claim, and therefore the amount for which you can sell it in the present and the number of years you can put on sale, is in part a history of the durability of technical structures, the difference when you're building structures out of iron and steel, or the difference when you're laying claim to oil reservoirs, oil reserves that have an extraordinary extended life that can be measured over decades. A very different kind of process than when one's looking at the financing of trade or the financing of a crop cycle. And I would say in the earlier period there was one particular example of a kind of durability that kind of extended beyond the others available. And that, curiously enough, was a trade not in something that was durable because it was made of iron and steel or concrete or structures of that sort, but that was the slave trade. And the slave trade was durable, the enslaving of humans, because it was the durability of a human life, because what you were purchasing when you purchased slave was not a particular good that would be consumed in a year or the value of a particular trade journey, but the value of an entire human life. Now, those human lives were foreshortened by the extraordinary conditions of slavery, but it was still a much more durable form of revenue, namely labor of that enslaved person, compared to other kinds of revenues that might have been available. So in fact, in the earlier period, in the 17th, 18th, into the 19th century, slavery was a particularly stood out as a particularly durable form of revenue. But mostly the kinds of durability that the book is talking about, that those that come from this combination of various technical processes, various materials, but supported and buttressed by the durability of legal arrangements that establish the rights of shareholders going forward over years, if not decades, the rights of property owners, many other kinds of legal and technical durability, whose durability is partly a matter of court systems and forms of policing and forms of unrest for enforcing claims and things like that. So durability is a sort of general word that can both refer to technical and material processes, but also to political and legal processes as well.
You write that perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, Egypt in the 19th century exemplified the power of money to make money. How was the ecology and geography of Egypt remade in that period?
So we have an image of the 19th century shaped by the Industrial Revolution, where the dramatic transformations take place in places like Lancashire in northwest England or in the northeast United States, and it's thought of around industrial production and so on. And one of the things I'm argued, and others, is that you have just as profound, if you like, industrial transformation in the case of a country like Egypt, where it takes the form, for the most part, not of building industry, though there was some, but of, as it were, industrializing the flow of the River Nile through diverting it, damming it, and using it entirely new ways. And that relates to this same process of putting the future in debt. But to effectively put the future in debt in the case of Egypt, one of the things you had to do was stop growing food, which tended to have a short growing cycle and to be consumed locally, and start growing crops that essentially were industrial crops. The two in the case of Egypt were cotton and sugarcane, that could be grown largely for export. But the difference with those crops as industrial commodities is they required much longer period in the ground, and in order to make that possible, to keep them in the ground, you had to stop the river from flooding. And so over the course of the 19th century and extending into the 20th, the River Nile, the flooding of the River Nile was brought to a halt. And the book not only details that process, which has been written about something before, and the ecological consequences, but shows how it was justified in part by a complete misunderstanding of how the Nile was used before. And I write an entirely new history of the River Nile prior to the building of the dams and the barrages that that brought an end to the system of flooding. And of course it was all justified in addition in terms of the risk of the ecological risk of excessive floods, and the book shows how excessive floods were actually a product of this system of damming the river, and that the kinds of ecological risks identified were actually something that became much more severe once the river had been damaged and destroyed in this way. So it's both an ecological history of breaking of the earth that you have to carry out to establish these kinds of control over the future, and it's also showing through a sort of history of hydraulics of what happens to a river, that these processes of capturing the future, of assetizing the future, don't only happen through so-called, you know, industrial tech or contemporary forms of tech, but through all kinds of ways of intervening in earth processes and diverting them, introducing new forms of destructiveness.
How widespread was that transformation, you know, beyond the borders of Egypt in the 19th century and into the 20th century? And do you see such transformations as being driven by this process of borrowing from the future to profit in the present?
It was very widespread. I focus on the case of Egypt because that's where a country where I've spent time and done a lot of research, but you find very similar processes going on in India, both in the Indus Valley and on the rivers of the east coast of India. You find it other rivers in Africa. You find it pretty much all over. It's not only something that happens through transformations of rivers, but one of the things it enables one to look at is a sort of larger history of capitalist transformation in the 19th century that does not center the story entirely on an industrial revolution in Manchester. Indeed, it tries to sort of provincialize Manchester, the center of the new textile industries in Britain, and it tries to place the transformation that happened around industry and industrialization, first of all in the context of a crisis in older systems of credit, but also by seeing that what was happening to the river systems and fields of Egypt or India or other places were indeed being driven by the same processes of capitalization, of capture of the future. We tend to have a much more naive way of thinking about the relationship between the sort of industrial core of the world economy, as it used to be thought of, and the periphery, where industry is driving the process and the role of the periphery is to provide the raw materials for that process. And I don't think that captures the extent or the reasons for what was going on. It's true that Egypt did become for a while a supplier of cotton to the textile industries of northwest England, but it also became a significant supplier of sugar and other commodities. But my argument is that one should understand this not just as a sort of need for raw material for something happening elsewhere, but for the opportunities on the ground in these places to transform ecology and social relations through this process of large-scale capitalization of the future, and the book looks at particularly what it was about cotton production or sugar production that lent themselves to this different temporality and this different way of using resources such as a river system.
How did the expansion of cities fit into this story beyond the kind of West versus the rest globally?
So, you know, we've talked quite a lot about the history of joint stock companies. But if you like, there was a whole parallel system of developing ways of impoverishing the future that developed around the same time, again with an earlier history, but from the late 19th century, turning cities themselves, turning urban life into sites of what I call capitalization or assetization, sites where you could build out a durable structure whose revenue would then be made available and become a source of profit in the future. And a lot of it is the same technical history, the same transformations that make possible, for example, building railroads, the development of particularly of steel and the ability to build with steel, the development of concrete and reinforced concrete, are other kinds of histories of durability. And they coincide with the development of the new forms of finance, and specifically the mortgage that finances the development of urban spaces, both commercial and large-scale urban development, but also the creation of residential housing, where if you develop the mechanisms that will make credit available, you can start to market to those who need a place to live a share in a future, sort of analogous to acquiring a share in a company, where the value of that share, let's call it an apartment in a new apartment building going up at the turn of the century or through the 20th century, the value of that share ceases to have anything significant to do with the cost of actually putting up the structure. What it becomes is the value of how much the developer can charge for the ability to live in that apartment, in that unit, for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So gradually, housing itself, the very business of having a home, becomes something else that is capitalized, and the person seeking a place to live then pays back to the developer, to the speculator, that cost. Now, it's not thought of as a new system of capitalizing the future. It's just described by saying, well, if we know the building only cost that much, X amount, but the other half of what you're paying is the cost of land. Well, you know, land doesn't have some innate cost. The cost of land that you're being told is what you're paying for is simply the capitalized value of being able to live in that building over the next 20 or 30 years. So housing itself becomes another sort of machinery for doing this, and it begins with sort of larger, more commercial, more speculative building, but then from the 1930s onwards with the invention of the mortgage, the modern sort of self-amortizing mortgage, where instead of borrowing money, it might be the case for sort of 2 years or 5 years to help you build a house, you're now told you can borrow that money over 30 years and not pay it back in a lump sum, but amortize it over those 30 years. So then suddenly the developers of speculative housing developments can charge the amount that you think somebody can afford to pay over those 30 years, and the cost of housing goes right up. And we're still living with that process where the cost of housing is not a reflection of what is, you know, only a partial reflection of what it costs to actually put up a structure, but is much more a reflection of this process of capitalization through the mortgage industry. And so half of the way people go into debt and half of what they now spend their wages on is this capitalized cost of living. And that's become an ever-increasing, of living in a particular place. And that's become an ever-increasing part of the way in which people's lives are encumbered with repayment in the future of the costs that have been imposed on them in the present.
I'm joined by Timothy Mitchell. We're discussing The Alibi of Capital, How We Broke the Earth to Steal the Future, On the Promise of a Better Tomorrow. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Tim, you write about the rise of this notion of the economy, which, rather than being something that's been with us throughout the modern era, you situate in the mid-20th century. And I wanted to ask you how you understand the economy versus how it's understood within mainstream economics. Is it a way of understanding the sort of universal realm of human life and then productive activity within it?
No, it's a very particular way of measuring and regulating well-being. So the book contains within it, in different chapters, actually a much longer history of economic thought, all the way back to those who are thought of as the sort of fathers of modern economics, Adam Smith and others. But then it focuses in on two moments. One is actually one we've been talking about, the 1870s, 1880s, and the rise of the joint stock company. And one of the things I argue there is that modern economics is born out of stock markets. And it's an argument extended over a period of time. But essentially, you can't get modern economics until you get this very bizarre and unusual notion of what prices are as this sort of system of information that is instantly available and always refers to exactly the object. And it's only with stock markets that you get that ability to generate instant prices for things. Never existed before with the way markets were organized. So there's a history of modern economics around stock markets and the kinds of pricing mechanisms. And you can think of what we would now call microeconomics, modern neoclassical economics, as something born by taking the idea of the stock market, in other words, the idea of selling shares in the future, as the sort of very essence of the way in which material life is organized, which is an extremely bizarre idea, but it's taken for granted still. The other major shift is the one that comes really after that system of sort of market-based neoclassical economic knowledge, along with apparently market-based economic systems that it was connected with, the sort of speculative world of stock markets and futures and so on. It goes into crisis and collapses in the 1930s. And it's a crisis that, of course, leads to fascism and total war and worse. And the whole thing has to be rebuilt during and after the war. And it's then, and only then, starting in the late 30s and then much more extensively, that economists start to use this new word, the economy. Economy has existed before, but economy meant to something like economizing, being frugal. But in the wartime and post-war period, as part of the reconstruction of forms of material life, initially just for the process of sort of organizing very large scale wartime production of arms, they're coming to being new ways of measuring what it is that goes on at a collective scale and not relying on simply on markets to sort of measure what's happening, and instead to think about the world as made up of large productive firms producing things, tanks, aeroplanes, guns and so on, and then eventually consumer goods as well. And those production of things then being paid for by consumers who in turn receive wages and so on, the whole thing circulates. And out of that you produce this entirely new idea of the economy, and you produce it in a particular way because you invent these ways of measuring what is being produced and what is being consumed, which was very hard to do in any systematic way before the 1930s. And you add that up as a total, and you come to call that total the gross domestic product, the GDP. And then you start to treat that total as the measurement of this new object called the economy, and you start to believe that your well-being is wrapped up in that process of the expansion or the growth of the economy. And it's significant that it happened in wartime because there have been many earlier efforts to sort of measure national income and through national income, national well-being. But it always was confounded by the problem of that people are spending a lot of money on things that are actually, you could never think of as contributions to well-being. And the biggest example of that was spending money on weapons and warfare. And so the early attempts always founded on how do you count all these things that are indeed productive, people buy them, consume them, use them up. but they're not part of our well-being? And the answer was, well, we'll just count them anyway because the war's going on and we actually do need more tanks and aircraft. And we've continued that with that ever since. So every kind of destructive and form of expenditure, which is not actually a contribution to overall increases in welfare, and military spending is the biggest example, but you could also talk about spending on policing and on imprisonment, on medical care for conditions that could easily and much more cheaply be solved in other ways. All that becomes the economy, and its growth becomes this very strange way of measuring our well-being.
And you note that for one generation, this idea of the economy was then followed by the next generation's notion of the market as this way of understanding the central dynamics to economic life. And you suggest that in a similar way to how a focus on GDP and growth can actually obscure more than it illuminates, that the market did something similar. Can you discuss the way that this idea of the market keeps us from understanding, you know, beside the vast inequalities of the system, the dimension to which we are drawing from the future to enrich at least certain people in the present?
The book sees the development of this idea of the economy and the development of this idea of the market as sort of two parallel processes that are happening more or less in tandem through much of the 20th century, with one sort of receding into the background at a certain time and the other coming to the fore. The market is an older one, and I even mentioned how stock markets were the sort of model for the emergence of economics itself as a discipline. The idea that you could sort of govern collective life through the market with the crises that result in mid-century and lead ultimately to the collapse of global economic life in the Great Depression and beyond, the market sort of recedes, and it's seeing that we need some sort of bigger apparatus for managing things, and that's the birth of the economy. But the 1970s and into the 1980s, one has increasing difficulties with trying to pretend that people's well-being is served by thinking only in terms of the growth of the economy. And so there's a turn back to the older notion of the market, but it's when it returns in a new form, not as a way of referring to sort of particular markets for particular goods, but the market as a sort of principle for governing things. And that, of course, is the ideology of neoliberalism, which in the course of the 1980s and through the 90s becomes established as this sort of as another layer of governing and of disguising the way in which people are being governed. So that's the story the book tells about the market and the sort of conceptions of neoliberalism. What's different from perhaps other conceptions is it has places in this longer history, both of the earlier invention of the economy and of the processes of capitalization, because the particular technology that neoliberalism introduces is not so much that things should have market prices and market prices should dictate costs and benefits, but rather that is the process of assetization, of turning what used to be public services, as I mentioned earlier, take healthcare as an example, into something that can be organized not as a public good that is provided out of general taxation, but as something that is provided through forms of private finance, and that can then be the shares in that public good that can then be sold off through a process of assetization. And at the same time, if you start to govern these things through these market-based price systems, you can tell people, well, we actually can't afford affordable healthcare. We actually can't afford affordable schooling or any of the other benefits that in the post-war period has seemed like they were going to be the future kind of collective goods that everybody would enjoy.
I'd like to end by asking you about this moment of increasing climate crisis, of course, but also war. You've written extensively about the ways that oil has been used politically, and I wanted to ask you how you understand this moment of the U.S. and Israel's attack on Iran through the lens of the argument that you make about the ways that capitalism borrows from the future to enrich the few in the present.
I think in a larger term of the last 25 years at least, we're seeing another sort of round of setback and crises for these processes of capitalization. And just as neoliberalism in the 80s and 90s and a little bit beyond was one set of solutions, more and more we're being persuaded that militarism is the way of doing that today. And that works on two levels. First of all, you can organize around sort of militarism and foreign threats and the threats of immigrants and everything else, a kind of hyper-nationalism that distracts people from what's actually going on. But also, of course, you can then justify the borrowing of quite extraordinary levels of money to pay the cost of fighting these wars. And so the U.S. military budget is now at $900 billion, but it's actually much more if you count in the cost of veterans care and many other things that aren't included in the military budget. And it dwarfs the spending on every kind of public good that one would want to have funded, for health, for public services of every kind, for environmental improvement and so on. And that is very important too, the reinvigoration of this constantly failing system of putting us more and more in debt. And that works through conjuring up these threats, whether it's the threat of the immigrant at home or the threat of Iranians abroad. If there is some threat that can be imagined and showed to need this extraordinary level of violence and of spending, you help sustain exactly the modes of placing burdens on the future that will enable continued enrichment of the few in the present. I mean, prior to this round of wars of the last 25 years, major wars were always paid for with a special charge. There was a special tax introduced, and often the government would do it by borrowing money at almost zero rates of interest. Now, nobody pays for wars in the present. It is just added to the national debt. And that began with the Iraq war, and it's being done again with the current war against Iran, as an imposition to be repaid from the future. And it's being done because, precisely, of the interest and of the need to orchestrate this kind of spending in the present as a way of continuing to find ways of expanding these processes of living at the expense of the future.
We have to leave it there. Timothy Mitchell, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Sasha. It's been really interesting to talk with you.
Timothy Mitchell is professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Columbia University, author of The Alibi of Capital. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.